Welcome back to the Khalil Osiris Podcast. In this episode, Khalil will have a truth and reconciliation conversation with Kent Justice, a reporter for News for Jax, WJCT. Kent started an ethnically diverse men's group after the murder of George Floyd to foster deeper understanding and support between men from diverse walks of life.
Kent, it's good to see you again.
It's mutual.
Yeah, it's last year. It's almost been,
It's been a year now.
A year. Nelson Mandela International Day last year, and the conversation with Dr. Mandela.
Yeah.
It was amazing. But look at how much has happened since then. COVID-19.
And we thought that was going to be the biggest deal of 2020.
Yeah.
No, not even close.
But I understand that you have started a conversation series.
Yeah.
A kind of truth and reconciliation conversations focused on how we can better understand each other.
Yeah.
And address this issue of racism and difference and ethnic divide. So I'm curious, Kent, with the position that you have of being an anchor and comfortable, a wonderful career and family, what inspired you personally to want to start this conversation series?
So I didn't intend to start a conversation series, but it became clear to me that conversations needed to happen. That's because one of my very dearest friends here in Jacksonville is a man who was struggling through that first week after George Floyd had been killed, who is a person I look up to and who is a leader and who I had never seen been anything other than sure of his course in life. But we had a conversation on that Friday of that week after everything had happened in Minnesota. Friday of that week. He said, I don't know what to say. I don't know what to tell my adult children who live in Atlanta and who are scared to go outside right now. And it started the conversation, just him and me, about his experience as a black man, as a leader of a black family. And I wanted to understand more. And it really, that was kind of the inspiration there. One friend who said, I'm struggling with this and I don't know what to say. And it took me to a place where I was just reading a sports article, really. I thought it was just about sports. No, it was my favorite sports writer, who is a black man, who was talking about, hey, why is it my white friends can talk to me about the NBA finals, they can call me and have a chat about anything in the sports world, but this really important topic comes up, and then where are they? And I read that and I went, "That I don't want that to be me. I don't want to be silent on something that is so important." So that's really what started it. And I, out of that moment, Khalil, I just went, okay, I'm going to call those friends that I have who may look different than me. Yes. And I'm going to say, I don't know what to say, but I'm going to say to you, I care about you. You are my friend no matter what. Yes. And especially when we're talking about there are differences because of how we look, I want you to know that I'm on your side.
Wow. And that, the personal friendship, the friendship that you had with this gentleman, you said he had been in the military.
Yeah, 32 years, Navy officer, leader,
And so here's a man who understands discipline, who understands order, who appreciates rule of law, and has dedicated his life to being a defender of this country.
Right.
And he struggled with what to tell his children, his sons in Atlanta who were afraid to go out.
Yeah.
The reason why that resonates so deeply with me is because for the first time in my life as an African-American man, I'm actually hearing other African-American men say out loud how wounded it feels not to have a sense of being able to protect the people that you're told you have an obligation to respect, but out of love, you feel a duty to respect. It's my encounter with that came early on as a child. It's like waking up in a dream that you've bought into and realizing that it's actually a nightmare. And let me give you an example. I remember being a little boy, growing up in a neighborhood, an integrated neighborhood. Our family was one of three African-American families in this community. And we all played cowboys and Indians. You know, we all played Tarzan of the jungle.
Right.
I mean, you know, as boys.
Kid games, yes.
I mean, we were boys. It's like we made Tarzan, we made the trees, we were like, we were those kids. And I was very athletic. I was one of the most athletic of our group. And I also was at the top of my class in academics. But I remember the day that I was saying that, like, it's my turn to play Tarzan. And my buddies, I was the only black one with my buddies. And there was my two best friends were twins. We just called them the twins. And so the one twin says, "You can't play Tarzan." I'm like, "Yes, I can. You played Tarzan twice."
Yeah.
I'm like, "What do you mean I can't play Tarzan? I'm Tarzan today." He said, "No, you can't play Tarzan." And the others two, they looked at me like, "No, you can't play Tarzan." That was so disturbing to me.
How old were you?
I had to be about 9.
Wow.
About 8 or 9.
Did they say it out loud? Did they say why?
No, they just said you can't play Tarzan. No. They didn't have to finish it.
Yeah.
They knew that I got it. They knew that them saying it and being in agreement at that young age, something I didn't know, a secret that I wasn't party to, as close as we were as friends. But the thing that was disturbing about it for me wasn't that they said, "No, I couldn't be Tarzan." What has disturbed me for many years is that I actually wanted to be Tarzan. Not that they didn't want me to be Tarzan, but that something happened.
It's been a while since you or I have been 9. It still penetrates, doesn't it? Yeah. It still hurts.
Because it's still happening. Didn't stop with me. And that's what this conversation is about.
Yeah.
How do we look at that? And I'm not saying it in a judgmental way. I'm saying that the lens is on me for my work, my progress, my growth and development. I want to question how I've been complicitous. I want to question how I'm able to come to terms with this deep contradiction in a way that allows me to be well.
Yeah.
So when you say that you were touched by your friend's candor.
Yeah.
it's really, 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 really difficult to have that kind of candor because of what it brings up.
Well, but the power of vulnerability, and it's not just a man thing, but a lot of times men are, hey, I don't want to let anybody know that I'm hurting or that I'm wounded or that thing a few years ago, a few miles down the road, stuck with me. But the power of being vulnerable to each other is part of what builds relationship at a deeper level, right? And as I've walked through, we've had a couple of the different sessions where we've had just let's talk about this. Let's not ignore it. Let's not forget the elephant in the room. Let's get into this. Yeah. Part of what's come out of that is the answer may be in better relationships, right? Deeper relationships. That it's hard for a person sitting on this end of the couch to hate the person sitting next to them if they engage and find out what's important to each other.
Absolutely.
Relationship could be the answer here. Now, there's lots of different ideas or suggestions or whatever about where we should go from here. But we've got to go in a way that brings us together. We've got to go in a way that reconciles. We've got to go in a way that says your children and my children shouldn't grow up in the same kind of environment that we have where it's okay that there's this divide, where it's okay because that's the way it's always been or whatever people say about this, Khalil. I don't want my kids to raise children in the same way. And so part of, I think, what's really come out of this last several weeks for me is trying to think of, well, why do I feel that way about people of other races? Why do I want to embrace their culture and understand more? And it's because, thank God, I had good parents who modeled that. Because I grew up in the San Francisco area, loved the Oakland Raiders. The first time I got to go to an NFL game, it was because my parents' friend, Lee Stark, had season tickets and said, Larry and Marilyn Justice, I'll take your son to the game with me. And so, you know, little white 13-year-old Kent with big, tall, African-American Lee Stark going to the game, that was a great thing. And it was a great way, without saying you should not see color like that, it was a great way for me to say, I see this beautiful gift that this man is giving me, and I love him for it.
Yes. Well, that's, for me, there's nothing more powerful to transform another human being's life than a personal relationship. Nothing. No programs, no initiatives, no trinkets. We're fundamentally wired to seek meaning with and in each other. We're hardwired as a species to be that way. And our humanity is always going to trump our ethnicity, our idea of race. Any concept or construct that we create to divide ourselves based on any factor you might want to point to, there is something underneath it that will always eclipse it. And so if we can allow ourselves to recognize that common point in our shared humanity, then the other things that we begin to have discussions about, we can agree that these are constructs, these are experiences, and many of these experiences that have given birth to the thing that we're calling systemic racism, it's a result of irreconcilable experiences. It's not just that we have different experiences in the context of systemic racism. And even if one doesn't accept that systemic racism exists, let's just take that out of the equation for the sake of those who would say it doesn't exist. In the context of the social structure that we have today in America, we have very wealthy people, we have very poor people. And in the context of that division of wealth, we're at odds with each other, and it becomes race, and it becomes racialized. So even if we don't believe it starts there, it ends up there in our discussions. So for me, I'm always asking myself, how am I contributing to it? And what can I do to deconstruct it?
Yeah.
Those two questions. First
question we all should be asking ourselves.
Yes, because I have more power over what I do with it than I do over what you do with it.
Great point. Yeah.
So I have to start from the place that I have the most power. I have the most efficacy. And it's not with what you do, it's with what I do. And that's where I find evidence of the real work being done. Because if you're not willing to recognize that we can have irreconcilable experiences and still come to the table and find common ground, then it's going to be very difficult for us to do anything more than be on opposite sides of the issues. And there are times when that's useful, but for the work we're doing, I think we're called to be more courageous than that, more curious than that, and certainly people who do more than that.
One of the, I think it was the first conversation that we had here, is about 10 of us together, and I kind of opened the discussion and said, hey, here's why, and you know, I want to find a way that we can live with purpose and care about each other, and then show that, right? And one of the folks who's gathered around said, Kent, I'm glad you bring it up, and by the way, it's not easy to bring up.
Yes.
Which is even more why we should bring it up. And I'll tell you, Khalil, you understand this, but there have been people I've invited, hey, let's have this conversation, who have said, no.
Yes.
And sometimes it's been personal. I don't think I want to be associated with that person because they're on the other side.
Yes.
But I've also been amazed at some of the personal stories I've heard from people that I didn't know, who said, oh yeah, I've experienced this and this, and I see it this way. And I say, I never would have known that if we hadn't engaged in this conversation. And one of the biggest wins, if you will, out of this is a friend who told me just last weekend, Ken, I'm glad we had that conversation a couple of weekends ago, because I've realized I need forgiveness for this. I've thought about this the wrong way. I didn't think about it at the time, but I acted that way. I need forgiveness for this. And it's been powerful, because there's an awakening or something going on for so many of us, so many of our neighbors, who say, I guess maybe I'm open to looking at this a different way now.
Yes.
And that's huge.
You know, when as you were saying that, one of the things that really sparked a thought of mine is I've been hearing this concept, cancel culture. And basically the idea is that much of what's emerging now around systemic racism, the conversations that are emerging around challenging systemic racism and other aspects of societal injustice, the term that's now being thrown around is, it's called cancel culture. And cancel culture means that raising the issue of the racism and the racist history of iconic generals and others is an attempt to cancel the culture, to erase the history of that particular period in Americans, yeah, in America's struggle to be democratic. Now, what I anticipate that will happen in America is a backlash to everything that we're seeing right now in terms of the dialogue around structural change, fighting systemic injustice, overturning systemic racism. I anticipate that there will be a very, very strong backlash from people who have a very different view than the one that's being shared in this opening and awakening, if you will. And it's in that period of this ideological struggle, because I think that much of what we're doing, much of what America is going through right now is a cultural upheaval. It's a cultural transformation that's being engaged. And so when we say cultural, I say cultural because culture is the container for ideas and behavior. And what we're really struggling with is whose ideals will dominate the landscape about what our story is. How do we change our narrative in simple terms? And those who have a narrative that they have invested their lives to keep, there's a saying, a person changed against their will is of the same opinion still. We have deep work to do in this country before we can ever begin to think about transforming, yeah, the kind of wounds that would lead to a person whose family fought for the Confederacy and a person whose family fought for the Union, be they black, white, or whatever, as an American, to reconcile that wound will cause the kind of change that will transform our culture. Yeah.
Do you sense that that's happening? This feels, this time feels different to me. It feels like maybe that can happen.
Ken, you know, the reason why I am convinced that it's different this time, though we will not be spared the backlash. The reason why I'm convinced that it's different this time, a number of things have happened, but they're sociological, in the sense that we have been told by recent census that in the year 2045, whites will be a numerical minority in America. 2045.
It's coming soon.
Coming soon, right? So, and here's what I am convinced is happening, what I'm observing culturally on the landscape, is that there are some people who are thinking 2045 is when it's going to happen. What I would suggest is that those kinds of things don't happen by osmosis. If you do a study now of the ethnic groupings of children in kindergarten in America, whites are already at that point of being numerical minorities. So the antecedents for 2045 exist now. They're present now. And not only are they present now, but the kind of cultural shift of consciousness because of this dynamic of whites becoming a numerical minority, the thinking has shifted dramatically right under people's feet who have been stuck in an antiquated idea of what America is. America is something that's unfolding. It's dynamic. And so it's like watching someone It's like guys in our age group. I'm being 61. I know guys who still wear a ponytail. They got the little earring thing. Now, they keep a baseball hat on because they're bald all the way around through here, right? But they got the ponytail that hangs out, and it's stuck in the 60s. It's many of us, racism keeps us stuck in a period that was delusional from the start and becomes even more absurd as we become familiar with the reality of what an increasing number of people are saying to us they will no longer be silent about.
Well, see, that strikes me, because what you said earlier, person's, you know, opinion changed. I see around me people who are on their own saying, oh, I need to look at this differently. Oh, I feel this differently. My neighbor came to one of our conversations. And during a conversation about the monuments coming down in Jacksonville, we're saying, hey, wait a second. I don't understand this. And as I've heard in other conversations, led his comments with, I don't have a racist bone in my body.
Yes.
But, and then gave their opinion. And it struck me, just didn't realize maybe a racist bone in his body.
Yes.
And at the end of that conversation, at the end of that evening, this person told me, Ken, I'm going to have a hard time sleeping tonight.
Oh, yeah, I remember you.
Because I didn't realize that I viewed it in that way. And now that I've heard people explain to me why that's offensive, why that's painful, why that hurts, I'm forced to look at things differently. And again, it goes back to, we built some relationship over the course of a few hours. And this person sharing their experience, and this person sharing theirs, saying, huh, okay, I can understand it differently.
As we were talking earlier off camera, one of the things that came up is the power of conversations, of people just being willing to talk with each other and share what their experiences are, because they're your experiences or they're my experiences. It's not like they can be right or wrong. They're just our experiences. Yeah. And
can't argue with that. No, it's what happened.
Right. And it's how I have perceived, or I have chosen to interpret what has happened, because I know that, for example, in my own family, I grew up with a brother, and his interpretation of our childhood is very different than mine. So if you think
that happen for siblings, doesn't it?
And very different worldviews. Sometimes you ask yourself, did you grow up in the same house? Did you eat the same food? Wait a minute. I mean, that was your mom? That was your mother? That was your father too? Really? That's amazing. We have such different views. And I didn't see it that way at all, and you did. So if that can happen in a biological family, in our nuclear family, imagine what it would look like if we compound it with a whole host of other social issues. So we've got some serious work to do, but this is why I say it starts with ourselves, Kent, which is what I like about with your conversation, because you were triggered to reflect on how you want to be. And then you took action. You didn't wait on your buddy to call and ask, can you talk? You took the action that was available to you. That's starting with yourself. And that's what I mean is the place where all of us have to start the work.
Thank you for listening to the Khalil Osiris podcast. Tune in to the next episode to hear Khalil's Truth and Reconciliation conversation with Desmond Meade, the president of Florida Rights Restoration Coalition, and Kevin Gay, the founder and CEO of Operation New Hope.